It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Public education in the United States is constantly being criticized by parents, politicians, teachers, and pretty much everyone else, too. There's a fear of falling behind the rest of the world, and there have been many political initiatives put forward in the hopes of, quote, fixing our schools. But one of the problems that we seem to encounter is that interested parties don't necessarily agree on what our schools should be doing. This hour, we're going to explore the purpose of education. Later on, Ryan Weiss, director of the Iowa Department of Education, will be here along with two retired teachers who will share their insights. We also want to hear from you this hour. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And my first guest today is Chris Ogren, Associate Professor of History of Education in the Department of Educational Policy and Leadership Studies at the University of Iowa. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Now, a lot of the conversations that we have about education in the United States today focus on what students who graduate from high school are ready to do. There's a lot of talk about job readiness and college readiness. Now, when you talk with students about the purpose of education, I have a feeling a lot of your students think that's the role of our schools. But that's not your thought.
Well, a lot of people think that's always been the role of schools, that they've always been focused on preparing students for what comes next. And actually, if you think back to the 19th century, a lot of what school was about was instilling virtue and just teaching, preparing students to be learned people. And so I have to sort of remove the segment of my students' brains where they think it's all about job preparation. Our common system of schools originated just before the Civil War. The Common School Reformers, led by Horace Mann, most people have heard of Horace Mann, they were concerned about changes in the country. There was a rise in early industrialization, immigration, a lot of immigrants from countries like Ireland, and beginnings of urbanization. And they saw that change, and they were very worried about it. And so their solution was to create a common system of elementary-level schooling that would teach students to be good citizens and instill virtue. And that was their main concern. And by the way, they even welcomed girls quite readily, not because they thought girls would vote, because they couldn't, but because they'd be mothers. And so the idea was because girls would become mothers and they would need to raise good citizens, that they should have education as well. But it was about having a common culture more than it was about preparing people for jobs at that time.
At that time, a lot of the population of the United States was functionally illiterate. Reading and education, that was something that the higher classes pursued on their own. So was literacy one of the basic foundations? Was that considered to be fundamental to good citizenship?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that was very important. Actually, there was, by that time in the 19th century, I think literacy was more widespread. A lot of people learned at home or even before the Common School Reform, schools were pretty widespread. They just weren't organized into a system. They were very localized. So, but using that literacy, furthering that literacy in order to create good citizens was a big part of it. And also, by the way, reading the Protestant Bible in school was, they viewed that as part of being a good citizen. They wanted them to be good Protestant citizens, and they were concerned about new diversity, because a lot of those Irish immigrants weren't Protestant, and that was a big concern of the reformers.
Now, as those schools were put into place, how many years of education were considered to be necessary to produce good citizens?
Probably not that many in our minds. 4 years, maybe 5 years, as long as a student could stay. Also during this time, public high schools began to appear. There had been academies and grammar schools before that, but the first public high schools appeared before the Civil War, and not many students went. But again, it was boys and girls. And even those high schools focused on citizenship and, like I was saying, being a learned person, not job preparation. Students might take bookkeeping, but it wasn't in order to be a bookkeeper. It was in order to know numbers and to be able to work with numbers. So even early high schools did not focus on preparation specifically for jobs.
Now, of course, we know today that schools do many things and fulfill many different roles. When did things really start to shift, to move beyond the idea of just producing good citizens?
Big changes occurred that still influence our education quite a bit during the late 19th century, and especially the Progressive Era around the turn of the 20th century. If you've heard of the Progressive Era, if you think about what your dusty memory of history, huge waves of immigrants, industrialization in the form of assembly lines and really regularized production, and big cities taking shape for the first time. All of those changes, just like before the Civil War, really inspired a lot of changes in schooling. And the idea of learning by doing, and maybe you've heard of John Dewey, his philosophy of learning by doing became important during this time. But what John Dewey meant by learning by doing was that everyone could benefit from working with their hands and learning how to do things like we might think that you would do in a shop, industrial shop, that everyone, or girls it would be sewing, by the way, but everyone could learn how to be better with their hands, and this would benefit everyone. One of John Dewey's disciples said that their goal was to make every working man a scholar and every scholar a working man. But what happened in the Progressive Era is those ideas became morphed. If you think of assembly lines and the extreme focus at the time on efficiency, the idea became to figure out what each student would do in the future and prepare the student for that. So what we saw then was the origins of what people now call tracking in high schools, that certain students would be prepared for industrial work, certain students would be prepared for college, and that's really where a lot of what we know took shape.
Now, of course, when the public education was first founded, it was supposed to be an opportunity for all students, a free public education. It wasn't compulsory for all young people. When did that idea shift where we decided, no, this is something that needs to be available, not just available to all students, but all students or all possible students mm-hmm. need to be a part of it?
That was part of the reform of the Progressive Era as well. And again, if you think about the fact that the new waves of immigrants coming in, new waves of students moving into school, were different from what leaders perceived as traditional students. And so they wanted to be sure everyone was prepared for their future economy, prepared for life in the U.S., and they began to pass compulsory school laws. So it's late 19th century into the early 20th century. They weren't all enforced, but the laws appeared during that time. It was in the 1930s that half of students in the United States were in high school, half of that age group. So you can see that continuing as well.
So part of the role of schools then became assimilation, turning immigrants very much into Americans.
Exactly. Yeah. No good. So it's, yeah, what do we want people to do? We want to teach them job skills, and we want people to share this American culture, and the schools are the way to do that.
Now, there's also an idea about schools that education is your ticket out of your social class. For example, if you're in a lower socioeconomic situation, education should give you a lift. This mm-hmm. should help elevate you. Where does that idea come from?
It's been there. I mentioned those early high schools, even before the Civil War. It really wasn't the overt focus, but a lot of students began to see that if they had that credential, it could help them get a job, not because of the content of what they learned, but somehow having the credential distinguished them. And so those high schools, and of course higher education operated this way too, became this way to social mobility, to a higher social class. What happened, that rhetoric has stayed there throughout, but throughout the 20th century, unfortunately, it has become harder to move up in social class through education. And there many sociologists of education and historians of education have shown that during the 20th century, a lot of what we consider social mobility efforts or that credential effort really reinforced the social class structure more than it allowed for mobility. There are always a few examples of mobility that make us feel like it's possible and it's part of what we do in America. It's part of the American dream.
Those are our favorite stories to tell.
Exactly. And they're there. But more and more, as the 20th century went on and into the 21st century, it's more about people who have advantage in social class maintaining their advantage in social class through educational credentials. And if everyone achieves high school education, for example, then more people will get college. If more people have a bachelor's degree, then people with more advantage can get a master's degree or a PhD, and it kind of goes up like that.
Now, I mentioned at the very start that so many of us seem to have different ideas about what schools should be doing, and that is a large part of the political process, push and pull. So looking throughout history, you've already mentioned several different movements, these different ideas of what our schools should be that become popular. I mean, that really has shaped what our schools are.
Yes. And you see a lot of discussion about it, especially during times of change. I mentioned the change before the Civil War, huge change during the Progressive Era, during the Cold War era, especially the early Cold War, late 1940s, 1950s, a lot of concerns about school. The Soviet satellite Sputnik, a lot of people have heard of that in 1957. Educators, people leading education, use that to say our schools aren't good enough. And really, the U.S. technologically was pretty even with the Soviet Union, but because they launched the first satellite, a whole movement went on to say our schools need to be more rigorous, need to offer more rigorous education. And by the way, not for everyone, but for the talented students.
Interesting. Well, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. This hour, we are talking about the purpose of education, something that I think we all have ideas about. And we'd love to hear your ideas this hour as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. My guest right now is Chris Ogren, Associate Professor of History of Education in the Department of Educational Policy and Leadership Studies at the University of Iowa. We'll continue in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the purpose of education. That's something that we all have ideas about. Schools are constantly being criticized. They tend to become political footballs, well, pretty much every year and every time there's a change in leadership. And this hour, we're talking about our ideas about what schools should be doing. And we were looking at where a lot of those ideas came from with Chris Ogren, Associate Professor of History of Education in the Department of Educational Policy and Leadership Studies at the University of Iowa. And now I want to turn to Ryan Weiss. He is the director of the Iowa Department of Education. Hello, Ryan.
Hello, Charity.
Oh, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So let's start with your big picture at the Department of Education. If you were asked, what is the purpose of the schools in Iowa today, public education, what's your answer?
So we talk at the Iowa Department of Education about ensuring that, you know, schools are preparing students for the world of the future, that our students have the capacity to grow a successful, healthy and productive citizens in a global environment. And so we want to ensure that our schools are equipping our students with the skills they need for the changing world.
So we were talking about this idea that our schools need to prepare students for careers, for jobs or for college. And that's something that a lot of us as parents and a lot of students really focus on, especially in the high school years. How much of the focus do you feel should be on that in our schools?
Well, I think that's a critically important part of education, to ensure that our students are set up for success, that they're prepared for future education and ultimately for careers. It's not the only purpose, though. I appreciated Professor Ogren's framing, you know, about this oftentimes a dichotomy between preparing students for what comes next versus, you know, just having an educated population, learned people, she said, who are virtuous. And I think both of those things can be accomplished. I don't think it's so much people with different purposes for education. I think sometimes the priorities shift depending on who's talking about education.
Well, and education is such a big subject. Schools are doing so many things that I think a lot of times the conversations that we have, particularly politically, focus on how to measure whether or not schools are doing that. And that's an incredible challenge, isn't it?
It is a challenge, but I think one that's possible. Certainly people have different opinions on, you know, how you measure the performance of schools, but education is a big investment, and I think parents, taxpayers, the public want to ensure that their students are receiving the best education possible.
So the conversation has to turn to testing. We hear a lot about standardized tests. Our students spend a lot of time at school taking these tests, and a lot of people do judge the value of an education, the success of a school, by those test results. But they're also incredibly controversial. So what do you feel the role of those standardized tests is?
You know, I feel that standardized testing and assessment does play an important role, but it should be properly framed. So assessment ultimately should be a tool for teachers to say, okay, how are our students doing? Are they mastering what is being taught? And how can I, as a teacher, adjust my instruction to meet the needs of students? Also, assessment serves an accountability purpose for the public at large to say, okay, how are our schools doing? How are each grade level? How are they performing? At the Department of Education, we're responsible for developing a state report card. And I always say the state report card should be an opening point for conversations between parents and schools. It should not be the end point. I think it can really further dialogue and say, okay, how are our students doing? And then tell me why, as a principal, do you feel like they're improving, or where are the challenges? So I think it serves both those purposes of informing instruction and providing accountability when used in the right ways.
Now, of course, there's a lot of criticism of schools who want those test scores to be great because that's how they're being judged, focusing on teaching to the test. I mean, I understand the assessment goal is supposed to be to test how well things are being taught. But if you're focused on preparing students to do well on the test, that also shapes the curriculum.
Right. It can, again, to a point, you know, ideally you have a well-rounded assessment and well-rounded instruction that you're not targeting instruction so specifically to specific items on a test, but you have a set of standards of what you want your students to know and be able to do at the end of a lesson, at the end of a unit, at the end of the year, and you're providing opportunities for students to demonstrate mastery of those standards. And so ideally, a test would be broadly constructed to demonstrate mastery in a range of items under those standards, and teachers are instructing to a range of activities that meet those standards.
I know a number of teachers who are currently teaching today who I've talked to who are frustrated with the amount of time that they have to invest in doing those assessments. And, you know, whether there are benefits or whether there aren't, there is this level of frustration about, well, if I didn't have to do a reading assessment with every single child in my classroom four times a year, then I could be spending more time teaching those students. What's your response to that?
You know, I certainly hear those concerns when I'm out in schools, which I try to do every single week. It causes, you know, when I hear concerns like that, it causes the department and schools to take a good hard look at what is the purpose of testing and to really ensure that we're doing it in appropriate ways. I do think, you know, you mentioned specifically the reading screening that actually happens three times a year is important for identifying challenges that students have with reading early on, before they become full-blown problems. We know that one in four Iowa students are not reading proficiently by the end of third grade. And identifying those challenges early on is critical so that those students get the additional support they need so that they're reading proficiently by the end of third grade, that they're then able to access more rigorous, more challenging content as they progress through upper elementary, middle, and high school, and then on to post-secondary education or the workforce.
Well, and since we were talking about the reading proficiency in third grade, it's an interesting case study in an idea that, you know, I think everybody would like all students who finish third grade to be proficient readers, to be reading at grade level. There are disagreements about how we should go about doing that. But also, we've had this big legislative push to make it happen and then to provide every student who's not proficient with the summer school opportunities. Now, there has been stepping back from that for monetary reasons, for logistical reasons. As you are doing your best to try to make Iowa schools as good as they can possibly be, working with legislators, working with all of these ideas, and then working within the funding parameters that you know has been declining or at least holding steady in recent years. I mean, how do you in the Department of Education, how do you focus on goals without necessarily having the funding to make these goals happen?
Well, you know, one thing I think is important to remember with the Early Literacy Initiative specifically is that there is still almost $11 million in targeted early literacy funding coming to the state of Iowa in this coming fiscal year. And that really builds on the work that we at the Department of Education, in partnership with area education agencies and our schools, have done to focus on this early identification of students who struggle to read, in providing the additional instruction they need to catch up, and in communicating effectively with parents. And so we will be good stewards of the resources we do receive, as I know schools are as well, to ensure we meet those goals. You know, the goals have not changed. The focus on early literacy has not waned. And so we will continue to push forward and do everything we can. And it's not only in literacy. You look at a number of state initiatives. We are very focused on ensuring we continue to improve career and technical education so that students have robust career and technical pathways as they move from elementary into middle and especially into high school. The state's focus on teacher leadership, nearly $150 million a year, is targeted specifically at building the capacity of teachers. So while funding is always a conversation, it can be a challenge. We will stay, as I know schools will, focused on the goals.
I'm talking with Ryan Wise. He's the director of the Iowa Department of Education. Education historian Chris Ogren from the University of Iowa is also with us. We're talking about the purpose of education this hour, and we'd love to hear from you. 866-780-9100 is the number to call for you to be a part of the conversation. And Tim is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Tim. Tim is not on the line in Des Moines. Tim, you can give us a call back. 866-780-9100 is the number. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I want to bring a couple of teachers into this conversation. I'd love to have all of you interact with each other because there's so many different ideas going around this hour. Michael Peterson is here. He's a retired teacher who lives in Iowa City. He taught in Northwest Iowa, in Vinton, and Iowa City, retired in 2010. Mike, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And give me a little bit of an idea of your background. You've taught around the state of Iowa, but also different grade levels, different focuses.
Yes. My career is, I started in Northwest Iowa in a little town called Sanborn. From there, moved to Vinton, and from there to Iowa City. I started out as a sixth grade teacher and then got my master's in talented and gifted education and then spent the rest of my career in talented and gifted. During that time, I worked everywhere from kindergarten through high school. So it's been quite a variety. Probably the bulk of it, most of it has been in the elementary and in the middle school areas. So
take me back to Mike as a young teacher, getting involved in education at the very beginning. What would you have said that your idea of what the purpose of education was when you started out?
When I started out, I really think that I thought that the purpose was to get children, the students, to grow into being a well-functioning citizen of society, someone that was able to grow within themselves, but also be a contributing member of society in one way, shape, or form. Be that it could be. I had my education in high school was we had very strong vocational programs also as well as college prep, and so it ran from one end to the other, and that's what I thought education should be, is be able to provide that for all students.
Did you feel like you were getting that job done as a teacher and teaching sixth grade?
Well, starting out in sixth grade, yes, my job there really I thought was preparing them, because at that time sixth grade was the end of elementary and then they went to junior high, depending now whether it's middle school or whatever, it's different. But my job really at that time was making sure that those kids were ready to go into junior high and continue on from there. And I think, as a young teacher, I thought, sure, I was doing a good job.
So as the years went by, I'm sure you had times when you were frustrated, and I'm sure that there were times when maybe you didn't feel like your school was doing what you felt like it should be doing. Give me a little bit of an idea of how your thinking evolved over the years as an educator.
Well, the working with students was always the same. And I think that's why most educators get into it, is because I loved working with the kids. Excuse me. And the difference is the amount of time that is kind of put on to education as testing, as was said, record keeping, which is a natural part, but more the politics, maybe part of the system that you don't enjoy as much, but the kids are the reason that you're there and to see them develop and grow.
I want to bring my next teacher into the conversation as well. Charles Blair Broker retired from Cedar Falls High School, where he taught AP psychology for many years. He still teaches occasionally at the community college level. He was my AP psychology teacher a long time ago at Cedar Falls High School, and he is with us now. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Charity. It's great to talk with you.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And give me a little bit of an idea of your teaching background. Fill in the picture for us.
Well, I spent almost my entire career at Cedar Falls, over 30 years, over 35 years. I was hired as a social studies teacher, but my focus was always psychology. So along with a little history, a little government, it was mostly psychology. And then in 1992, when the AP psychology course was born, most of my efforts switched to that. And I spent the last 20, 25 years teaching mostly AP psychology.
So as you were drawn to education at the beginning of your career, how would you have characterized what you felt the purpose of education was at that point?
Boy, I kind of liked what Chris said early on. I think maybe I was born a century too late. I always thought that my job was to turn my students into learned people. And when I was hired to teach psychology, I thought, well, that's what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to teach psychology. When I was hired to teach a history class, I wanted to make sure that, you know, students learned about the Depression, learned about the Civil War. And I was very literal in terms of what I thought that task was.
Were there times when you felt like you couldn't accomplish that, that there were changes to how schools were functioning that maybe got in the way of that?
I think I always maintained that focus on content, maybe more than most teachers did. And I was always frustrated because I could never teach as much as I wanted to. In any course I've ever taught, I've loved the content. I've been passionate about it. And my idea was to try to create some of that excitement, some of that passion in my students. And when things came up that were more political in the building, I just worked around them to try to meet whatever those constraints were and continue to do what I thought my job was.
Now, over the years, the structure of a school day has changed a lot. Did you find that your classes were getting shorter over time, that it was harder to fit that content in?
Yes, they kept slicing minutes off, and I always hated that because there's never enough time. I think a teacher's most precious resource is not money, is not books, it's time. It's the content, it's the contact that you have with the students. But those frustrations are always there. And when I started, I would look at the veterans, and they would complain about how bad things had gotten. And in my mind, they weren't bad. They were great. And toward the end of the career, I would be the guy that was complaining, the old grouch. And the new teachers came in with all the excitement. I think that's just a never-ending cycle.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking this hour about the purpose of education. With me, Charles Blair Broker, who retired from Cedar Falls High School, where he taught AP psychology and psychology for many years. Mike Peterson is here. He's a retired teacher who taught most recently in Iowa City. Ryan Weiss is with us, the director of the Iowa Department of Education. And Chris Ogren, associate professor of history of education in the Department of Educational Policy and Leadership Studies at the University of Iowa. We'd love to hear from you. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're exploring the purpose of education. And I have with me Chris Ogren. She is an education historian at the University of Iowa. Ryan Weiss is here, the director of the Iowa Department of Education. I've got two retired teachers with me. Mike Peterson, retired from teaching in Iowa City, where he most recently taught talented and gifted students, although he taught at many different levels. Charles Blair Broker is here with us. He retired from Cedar Falls High School, where he taught AP psychology and psychology for many years. And we'd love to hear from you. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Jeff is on the line in Polk City. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I'd like to put a little bit of a different spin, if you will, on why I believe businesses should not only champion, but also, of course, encourage everybody getting a good, solid quality education. If you look at it from the standpoint of a buyer's market and a seller's market, a seller's market is something where it's strong for the seller because there's not many of a wanted product available, so they can tend to hold their price higher or at least not have to go down any, whereas with the buyer's market, the buyers are in control because there's a lot of product available. And so it's easy to go from one place to another to get a better price. And my analogy is that with businesses, if you only have, let's say, 10 people that are qualified educationally wise for a certain job, there's going to be a lot of businesses that are competing to get those people in working for their business. So it's going to tend to drive the wages higher to get those people. Whereas if you have 100 people that are qualified to do a certain job, there's more competition from the job seeker standpoint. Businesses have more people to choose from. So, theoretically, it makes sense to me that would help keep the wages down.
Okay, so focus that on education. I mean, there's an economics lesson there, but how does that influence what we should be doing in schools?
Okay, because if businesses are helping to make sure that everybody gets a good quality education, then there's going to be more people inevitably available to do whatever variety of jobs are out there.
Okay, so you really feel that the focus of job readiness should be the focus of our education system?
Yes.
All right, Jeff, thank you so much for sharing that. And I mean, Ryan, I'm sure there's a lot of pressure on the Department of Education in Iowa. Because of all of these economic pressures, there is certainly a lot of talk about preparing students for the workplace. And we were just listening to teachers talk about, we want to educate learned citizens. Yep. So, I mean, there's a lot of push and pull there. How do you cope with that?
Well, I don't see it as an either or. It's a both and. We can do both of those things at the same time. We can ensure our students are highly skilled, that they have the qualities businesses need and desire, and at the same time that we have an educated populace that are ready for civic life, as both teachers mentioned. I just came out of earlier this morning a press conference at my own son's school where the lieutenant governor was talking about the new computer science legislation. I think that's a great example of a needed field. We need folks who have a strong background in computer science, And at the same time, when students are engaging in computer science classes, they're not just learning the content. I agree with Charles, that's critically important. I was a social studies teacher as well. But I also think the learning skills that go along with learning content are critically important as well. Being able to work collaboratively, being able to use technology, all of those things that we want both in our citizens and in careers.
Well, and Charlie, working in social studies, which is an area that there's been less and less emphasis on over the years. I mean, there has been a lot more emphasis in recent years on STEM education. Now, I never thought I was going to be a psychologist. I loved your class, but I don't feel like in any way you were getting me ready for a job. Has that been a source of frustration for you, this focus on job readiness?
It is. And for me, the frustration, I think, is the mismatch between what the public thinks my field, psychology, is and what psychologists think the field is. So I consider psychology a STEM class. It's a science. It evaluates evidence. It poses hypotheses. It tests. It uses statistical analysis. It does everything that a science should do. And it does it to study important things, the way people behave, the way people think. And I also agree that the skills piece is important. And maybe the way I evolved most in my years of teaching is to realize is that that the content was a way to teach people how to think critically. And we talked about literacy earlier, and the fact that third graders aren't reading well enough is certainly important. But we also have technological literacy. We also have numerical literacy. I can't tell you how many students really didn't know the difference between a million, a billion, and a trillion. That's an important thing to know. And now we need media literacy. With everything that's available on the internet and the need to discriminate between what's good and what's bad, what's real and what's fake, and social studies classes, as well as English classes and any other number of classes, can help students master the skills that they're going to need to succeed in the world.
It's hard to test critical thinking skills.
It is hard to test critical thinking skills. Testing, as you pointed out earlier, is fraught with problems, and yet I believe in tests. And I think that you can at least develop tests that require students to apply knowledge rather than just memorize it. And you can devise tests that allow students to analyze and interpret rather than just memorize. And when you do that, you're approaching critical thinking.
Well, and Chris, I want to talk with you a little bit about testing, because I guess a lot of us grew up taking the Iowa Test of Basic Skills. The Iowa assessments are also very common standardized tests now. So standardized tests have many of their roots here in Iowa, right?
Right. I work in Lindquist Center at the University of Iowa, which is named for E.F. Lindquist, who started the Iowa Test of Basic Skills and then went on to found ACT, which is a big presence in Iowa City. And an interesting thing, Lindquist, in the first half of the 20th century, he believed that testing was about figuring out who needed more help in schools and helping to figure out where students were. He did not believe that testing should be about ranking either students or schools. And I think a big shift has happened to the present, where we do use testing to rank both people and schools. And we've turned away from what Lindquist had in mind in doing that. The big rival, of course, to the ACT all along has been the SAT, started by the College Board. And they saw the SAT in the early years, like 1930s and 40s, as really equivalent to an IQ test. And when you talk about more like IQ testing, you're thinking more about figuring out who's smartest, who's best, ranking students. And so the ACT and SAT historically had these different purposes. Now they've come together more. The SAT doesn't claim to be an IQ test anymore. But I think it would help us all to remember what E.F. Lindquist had in mind, rather than using, you know, parents looking at average test scores of schools to figure out where they want their kids to go and things like that. That's really not what E.F. Lindquist had in mind.
Well, and Ryan, I'm sure that having all of these statistics available, I mean, we were just talking about the social sciences, and working with statistics is a very important part of that, but having access to all of these statistics gives you an incredible power to look at schools in a way that's really difficult to do without the statistics, because it is so ephemeral. There are so many different parts and so many different pieces of information and different ways that students learn and different ways that teachers teach. So, I mean, having all of those statistics, it must be difficult to look past them. Do you feel like that's a challenge for people who are involved in education policy?
You know, I think it can be a challenge when people want to look only at the statistics. I think it's important, again, to take a broad look at the success of our schools. And I do think the statistics, the assessments are important. You know, we know that there are huge achievement and opportunity gaps in Iowa and our country. And so we need that data to ensure that all kids are having the opportunity to get great educational experiences, and that their progress is being monitored and supported, not in a punitive way, but in a way that really goes back to student learning and student success, so that they're prepared beyond school. And at the same time, I always talk about the need to be in schools, to talk to educators, to talk to teachers like the great ones you have on today and teachers who are currently in the system, to say, okay, where are the challenges? Where are the opportunities? How can we support, either as a Department of Education or as community members or parents, support the work of schools? So it's important to take that holistic view, to use data and numbers where it helps, and also recognize the limitations. And when there's a need to learn more and to have actual conversations.
Well, and Mike, I'd love to ask you, because you most recently taught talented and gifted students, and I think that a lot of parents have a concern about, you know, are the so-called talented and gifted students, do they get opportunities that other students could also benefit from just because they've been singled out in some way? I'd love to hear your thoughts on reaching all the students in a school.
Well, yes, I think that one of the misconceptions is that these students are given things that others aren't. They're given things that are more on their level and more challenging for them. excuse me. The whole purpose of the program should be to find, again, do some diagnostics to find out where they're at, find out where their interests are, and then develop things that they can improve, grow through. And I think that's pretty much should be the same with all students. Even though I have my
master's. I was going to say, do you think it is?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure. It should be. I have my master's. When I got my master's, it was under the auspices of the special education, so I also took a lot of special education classes. And there's a lot of things that are similar in that you should be looking at the child, each student, to find out where they're at and then develop what's needed for that student rather than a one-size-fits-all type situation. Whether they all get that or not, a lot of that, again, depends upon the school, depends upon how well things get done within each school, the process that happens there. Also, I don't know, I think everything falls back to finances. You know, if there was some real support financially, we could do a lot more with every child, not just the which I dealt with, mostly the talented and gifted students.
And Charlie, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that as well, because although you're not, you weren't specifically a talented and gifted teacher teaching AP psychology, those were sort of self-selected students in the upper echelon, academically speaking. What are your thoughts?
Well, that's changed over the years as well. And in a lot of schools, Cedar Falls is one of them. It was a self-selected group of students who took AP classes. But for me, one of the most fun things about teaching AP was when a student who didn't have such a high grade point average, who didn't have quite as much confidence in him or herself, wanted to take an AP class. And they would have to come and get special permission at Cedar Falls to do that. But I almost always allowed it if they had a realistic idea of what the course entailed. And to see that student gain in confidence and ability and skills and knowledge as the course went on was really a wonderful thing. College Board does encourage schools to have a very open policy when it comes to students enrolling for AP classes. And I think that's a good thing because it does provide challenge and it does allow students to stretch in ways that maybe they didn't even realize they could.
So we just have a couple of minutes left, and this is such a big subject. It's hard to break it down. But Charlie, if you could change one thing about the structure of schools to meet more of the purpose that you'd like to see them pursue, what would it be?
Boy, what a great question.
Not a fair question at all.
Who knew it would be so complicated, right? I think the opportunity to provide more opportunities for students, to give them more choice, to not lock them into a curriculum or a sequence of classes where they can't really explore the arts, where they can't really take an academic load that they might want to take, where they can't really work with athletics. I love the idea of a well-rounded education, and I think sometimes students are so trapped by this notion, I need this to get into college or I need this to get into my career, that they miss out on a lot of opportunities, and that's sad.
Mike, what about you? What's the one thing that you'd change?
Oh, I think the opportunity again there, you'd mentioned Sputnik earlier. I was a beneficiary of the post-Sputnik era where it increased the sciences especially. I got to go through the Talented and Gifted program myself. But our school also had the, as I said, a strong vocational program, which my brother went through. Everybody, I really felt at that time in our school, everybody had a chance to explore the areas that they wanted to go to. And I think that is probably one of the most important things.
And Ryan, what about you? I know that's an extra difficult question for a person in your position, but what do you think?
You know, for me, it's about staying the course instead of continually shifting priorities. So I think we see a great example in the focus on teacher leadership, in building the capacity of our teachers and ensuring that they work in a collaborative environment. They receive great professional learning. They can work together with their colleagues. We have a tremendous investment in that in Iowa. And I think if we can stay the course on fundamental focus areas like teacher leadership and continue the focus on the areas of early literacy that I talked about earlier and on career and technical education, these key drivers of student success in the short and long term, we'll be well positioned in our education system in Iowa.
Ryan Weiss, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Charity. It was a pleasure to be on.
Ryan Weiss, the director of the Iowa Department of Education. And Chris Ogren, I'm going to let you have the final word here. You started off by talking about trying to teach your students to let go of some of their thoughts about what education is supposed to be for. What do you want all of us to know about the purpose of education that might change how we look at our schools?
Good question. I think part of it is to remember that the current focus on job preparation and preparation for what comes next, it historically is very new. And so just to remember that this is a recent development, this isn't what schools have always been. And if I can throw in one more thing, I'd like to echo what Ryan said about supporting teachers and underscore that. And not use testing to rank teachers and really support our teaching force because they're crucial to education.
Well, Chris Ogren, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Chris Ogren, Associate Professor of History of Education at the University of Iowa. And Mike Peterson, thank you.
Thank you.
And Charlie Blair Broker, thank you so much.
Thanks, Charity.
Mike Peterson retired from teaching in Iowa City and Charlie Blair Broker retired from Cedar Falls High School. This is Talk of Iowa.